Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Convergence 08 in Mountain View, California, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You're listening to an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today, we talk about where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future, and we take a pretty unusual view on those matters. To wit, we believe that there's pretty good evidence that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic, having a great time here at the History of Computing Museum where the event is taking place. How are you doing, man? Are you feeling better?
Oh, yeah. I'm not 100%, but I feel so much better than yesterday that's hardly worth mentioning. I think I'm going to get well quick on this one.
Well, you sound a lot better. So, glad you're feeling better, and thanks again for soldiering on last night. I thought we had a terrific show. Certainly had a great lineup of guests, and no end of interesting subjects to get into. And we've got a very similar lineup again today.
That's great. I feel like we may have worked through some of our technical difficulties. So, you know, I hate to jinx it by mentioning it, but
well, I tell you, this has been the big. We've been for those who aren't familiar with we talked about this a couple weeks ago. One of the big searches that leads to The Speculist is the phrase "Skype sucks," because of a post I did to that effect. I think about 2.5-3 years ago when I was a little annoyed with them, and we hadn't used Skype on our podcast at all until a week ago, and I realized that I was going to have to. There was no other way I could do live podcasts from this event other than with Skype. And let's grade them so far. I'm going to give them a B+. What do you think?
I'd give them a B. No plus on it.
Okay. A B. Yeah. If we get to the end of this one with no issues, we'll call it a B plus maybe. We had a little hitch at the beginning of yesterday's show when I was dropped immediately, and we've got just a slight issue with the guests who are live with me here in the room. They get a delay, and it makes it a little bit hard to follow what the other person is saying because you're hearing it in real time, and then about a quarter of a second later, and it's kind of distracting, but luckily, it's a very, very smart group that we're drawing our guests from here, so we haven't had any trouble. So I think if we get through this show with no incident, I'm gonna put a plus on the B, and I'm going to revise my Skype sucks post. So when people do a Google search and they come to The Speculist and it says Skype sucks, I'm gonna have all these great things to say about Skype. That'll be my my penance or my thank you to Skype for making this podcast possible.
That's right. And you've already got a guest right there, don't you, Phil?
We do. We can jump right on. We've got a guest with us. He is a good friend of this program. This is Brian Wong. He is the author of nextbigfuture.com, one of my favorite blogs, where he provides a detailed analysis of future technology, science, economics, and business-aware analysis of the kind of issues that we're talking about at Convergence 08. So, Brian, welcome back once again to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks, Phil. Great to be here.
So why don't we start off with you led one or two sessions yesterday at the conference?
Yesterday I had one session.
And why don't you tell us what that was about? What was on your mind?
That was a technology review updated to the latest stuff that I've covered on my blog. So that and also was going to lead into more discussions on impacts and some other things that I was covering. and to get some analysis around the future and that kind of stuff. I never got to that part of the discussion. It ended up being that I brought my presentation on a iMac, and it didn't have the proper dongle to connect it to a projector, so that because a Mac doesn't have those pin connectors, it had something else. Anyway, so I couldn't do my presentation, but I just used that as reference notes, and I had about 9-10 people around where I'd started discussing my technology update and didn't get out of the energy section of it. So, but it was a good talk, and
we have observed that a lot of discussions turn into discussions about energy, and it seems like once you're on that topic, it's very hard to get off that. People have a lot of strong opinions, and there's a lot of there's just a lot of different ways you can go, a lot of different angles you can take on it. So, what in particular were you discussing about energy?
So the first thing I was leading off with was people here and often in singularity talks will talk about the end of scarcity and that we'll get an abundance. And I was trying to and I've mentioned that in my mundane singularity and that kind of thing, where if you want to have everyone as rich as 5 times richer than our average American, say $250,000 per year, then you need to have more energy. And if you're going to spread that around the world, right now we use 15 terawatts of energy, and then the U.S. uses about 4 terawatts. So if you're going to have everyone at 5 times the U.S. level, you're up around 600 terawatts. So when people say, oh, we're going to have AI or this or that, and it's going to give us quote-unquote abundance, you really have to really ramp up your infrastructure. Even if you get more efficient, say 2 times more efficient, you're still talking about 300 terawatts. So a lot of power. So that was my kind of preamble to my discussion about.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying is that the issue is not just one of producing enough energy, but of achieving a certain level of efficiency.
So you have to get if you want to have abundance, you have to have scale. I have to have a lot of energy. I have to have a lot of material. We have 2.5 billion tons of cement used every year, 1.5 billion tons of steel, and our production of carbon fiber is around 46,000 tons, carbon nanotube less than 100 tons. So if we're going to get to the future materials or future energy kind of thing, you have to scale it up a lot. So if you get exponential manufacturing, which is one of the things that you might get with advanced nanotechnology, nanofactories, where you know, I make one thing, it makes two things, that two things make four things, and so on and so on. In 30 days, I've changed the world's infrastructure. Until we get something like that, then we're still doing things the old way. And the old way means I make a big factory, I make more factories, I scale my industry over decades, and then the world changes. So they have these historical analysis of how long it takes to shift from one energy source to another. And basically, we're still stuck at 50% coal, and that's the way it was for 150 years. So until we accelerate through that kind of stuff, it's going to take a long time. Yeah. And then, so I was reviewing then fission, fusion, superconductors, blacklight power, and EM drive and those kind of things, and looking at, and also some biofuels and that kind of stuff. So fission, because people underestimate fission, and that if you have mass-produced deep burn fission, it would actually be pretty fantastic. So factory mass produced means that you can make a lot of them, keep the economy's scale cost down, and then deep burn means that right now people get tied up in knots about nuclear waste. That's basically unburned fuel, primarily uranium, plutonium, not burned completely. So right now the reactor we got, 2-5% of the fuel gets burned on the first pass. So you need to go higher, 99% ideally, to get rid of most of that fuel. And then not only do you have less waste, but you also can stretch out your uranium supplies because you are using it, using more of it.
Now, is anyone looking to deploy that model of fission technology? Is that being
right.
used anywhere? Or?
Right. So there is a breeder reactor in Russia. There have been other breeder reactors in France and other places, but Russia is the main one who's using that. They have a in Belyarsk. They have a 600 megawatt breeder reactor, and the breeder reactor can use the high efficiency use of the fuel. So they've been running since 1980, and they're building a 800 megawatt reactor, improved version. That project had been delayed when the U.S. When Russia had their little hiccup changeover thing where they
right.
where their economy went to crap. But now they're all better now, and they're using their oil money to ensure that they stay energy power after they run out of oil and gas. So they're building their center thing of that strategy is to make more breeder reactors, and they and China signed up to buy another one of theirs. So they're gonna making their own, and China already said, "Hey, we want one too." So that is spreading, and then China's also working on factory mass producing high temperature nuclear reactors, a 200 megawatt version. They already have a 10 megawatt pilot plant, but they're making a 200 megawatt version. The cool thing about that is because you keep it under about 400 megawatts, the high temperature nuclear reactor will not melt down. You can turn off all the cooling and all that other stuff, and it'll just wind down itself. It won't, no risk of it having a meltdown. They did that to the 10 megawatt pilot plant, and based on the calculations, if they keep the size under 400 megawatts, then they won't have issues of meltdown. And then they can keep the scale, the efficiency of the big nuclear plants, you know, your 1-2 gigawatt plants, by just having, you know, 8 or 10 of these 200 megawatt plants all in a little circle, and they use the same control center. Mm-hmm. So you know, you're sharing and not having to replicate control centers for each one. Theirs doesn't do deep burn. It'll probably get up to 4 times the efficiency or so of our current reactors, to about what they call, I think, 200 gigawatts per gigawatt years per ton or something like that of efficiency. And then there's the Hyperion Power Generation, a startup venture funding.
And that technically is a form of fission reactor too, is that right? Or
Nuclear fission.
Yeah.
Nuclear fission, yeah. Theirs is a... they call it a nuclear battery, but it is, in fact, a liquid metal fission reactor, uranium hydride, which in the late 1940s and early 1950s, Edward Teller, famous mastermind of all kinds of nuclear bombs, tried to make it into a nuclear bomb, but he only got 200 tons of explosion out of it. So someone who really knew what he was doing could only get 200 tons of explosion out of something they specifically designed using this stuff to explode. So that is still 200 tons of TNT explosion. It's pretty big. It's about 4 times bigger than the biggest chemical bomb, the grandfather of all bombs or whatever from Russia. But it is, you know, small compared to our regular nuclear bombs. So it's safer stuff, and it can 50% burn of their material first time through. If you run it for 5 years and you pull up about a softball or football size amount of unspent fuel, which you then would reprocess for a second go around, and then you do recharge it, and then it'd be off to the races. And
Ron, is that the small reactor that could basically be delivered on site by a train car?
That's the one. That's the one that got covered by The Guardian and very, very popular reading right now on the internet. Yes, that's the one.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. So, what other topics in energy did you get into? You said you talked blacklight power. You talked fusion.
Right.
So now I saw a book. I was at a Barnes and Noble the other day, and I just was browsing books, and I saw this book about fusion, and it was the sordid history of nuclear fusion, and the guy was. The author was taking the position that it's just been one pipe dream after another, and he talked about cold fusion.
Right.
And I didn't read the book, so I'm judging a book by its inside cover here. But you could tell the slant was basically,
right,
this has never happened, this is never going to happen. And I was
mm-hmm.
thinking about Paul Sappho's curve yesterday, where the technology is going to get it
right.
wrong twice, where they say, you know, they get wildly optimistic and they get it wrong, and then they get too pessimistic and they miss it wrong. It seemed to me that probably to say that fusion's never going to happen would be to have committed that second error.
Right.
Where are we with fusion, and what was discussed in your session yesterday?
Well, I would agree that I don't like the international fusion project. The tokamak version, that one they've been sending you know, billions of dollars, a long time, you know, 1,000 PhDs or whatever working on this thing. And they're saying, well, maybe in a few decades we'll have up the this next version, which will have about break even, and then the one after that, well, that will actually be commercial, and then we'll have something. My problem with that one is that even if they succeed and they say, we actually deliver on this thing, so in 4 decades, we got one, right? It's a big fusion reactor. It is not aneutronic, so it's still spitting out neutrons. So instead of the deep burn fission I was talking about, if the thing is burning, you know, deuterium and whatever and making stuff, so you're getting it out of seawater. But the thing is, because it's a neutron, after 30, 40, 50 years, you still have a radioactive plant. You just have to decommission that. So compared to deep burn fission, where you're burning up 99%, and it's, I don't see the benefit. You know, I don't see why we go through this trouble, something that doesn't work, no, not doesn't work, but has this long development path, when a short development path would be to deep burn fission. So I like several smaller projects, and one of them is one that Robert Buzzard had started, the inertial electric static reactor. It was featured at the Google Talk. It was fairly well known around.
We've actually dedicated a whole show to talking about that one in the past. Yeah.
Right.
So.
But Buzzard, unfortunately, died a couple years ago. He was one early in on tokamaks. He was one of the ones who got that program started in the United States. But then after, you know, 10, 15 years, whatever, said that's not the way to go, but it already had gone on and was had a bureaucratic life of its own. And he was saying he wanted other things. And he settled on the Polywell fusion reactor, which is basically, if you think of a cloud of electrons, a big negative charge, if you hold it in place with, you know, magnets or electric statics, and then you release positive ions, the positive ions would then shoot towards this big negative charge. So that's the basic principle
right
behind the whole thing. And they have these things working already for a long time with a grid, a physical, you know, bunch of wire grids generating the containment and stuff like that. But the problem you have the wires is 1 or 2% of your ions or electrons are hitting your grid. And then you lose them. So then it doesn't give you the efficiency you need to generate power. It becomes a great generation of neutrons. So you can get like billions of fusion events, you get neutrons, and they use it for that in labs and stuff. But what Robert Buzzard did was get rid of the grid so that those things aren't hitting that physical structure, and then get 100,000 times more efficiency so that then you can get to actual power generation. So he had supposedly his last demo, his WB6 demo, was working on that. It shorted out. They got $2 million from the Navy, and another set of researchers who follow on with his work had then supposedly replicated that and is still working, not shorting out. And presumably they haven't published results yet. Has proved that should work. Still a lot of work to make it all the way to making something happen, but probably a lot less. Maybe 5, 10
But if those results come out, and if they're anything like what they should be, or yeah, what he would have, Buzzard would have said they were going to be, then it certainly would be a big step along that way. I think if anything's going to slow fusion down, it's going to be blacklight, which is if there's really something there, that's the only problem with that one. If it's real, then it seems like that one will probably get a lot of the attention, get a lot of the money, and probably get a lot of the momentum that some of these other competing things might have gotten.
Right, and that's the thing about because the scale that we mentioned in the beginning is so big to change stuff, that the traditional way of doing things is slower. So some of these dark horse, black swan type things that come along out of left field, and that's blacklight power. So that's the one where it has some guys feel it has created something with below the ground state of normal hydrogen, get to fractional ground state, so that kind of violates some quantum things where you can get past the integers supposedly. And he says he can catalyze and get down to 1/128 of a electron volt or whatever it is, and thus you can generate 128 times more power than regular chemistry would indicate. Supposedly he had that verified by Rowan University, and basically in a little video which shows how they did it, they have a little scuba-like tank which is filled with nickel powder, charged up with hydrinos, and then they set it off, and it generates more power than it should.
We summed up blacklight. We talked about it a few weeks ago, and I think the three possibilities with blacklight are it doesn't work, or it works but it doesn't work the way they think it does, or it works and then therefore the universe doesn't work the way we thought it did. Right? One of those three things has got to be the case with blacklight. Okay. Well, we're into the waning seconds here of Brian's time. Stephen, was there anything in the chat room for Brian, or any other questions for Brian?
No, not from the chat room. Brian, I mean, if you had to just put all your money on one scheme that's going to power the future, what would it be?
If I had to put it all on one scheme, then I'd have to go with the mass-produced deep burn fission because I have the fewest questions. It can scale. I think it would work. We have enough uranium in the oceans and all that kind of stuff that it'd be good for tens of thousands of years if we use 100 times more power than we do now. So if I had to go with one, I'd go with that. But I would prefer not to go with one. I'd prefer to spread my bets around 80% with the conventional things and 20% on as many competing wild-ass ideas I could find and then have them compete to win.
That's a good breakdown, 80-20. If we could get I don't know, the powers that be to have that rational of an approach, it seems to me we might make some faster progress. Well, Brian, we thank you for being on the program. It's always a pleasure, and enjoy the rest of Convergence 08.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to move straight to our next guest, who will be donning the headset here. Now, Michael Anisimov, no stranger to Fast Forward Radio. He is on the Lifeboat Foundation. He's in charge of fundraising for the Lifeboat Foundation, the director of that for North America. And, of course, he's a blogger at Accelerating Future, and he's a member of the board of directors for Humanity Plus. Michael, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Hey, Phil.
And Stephen's on also. You might want to say hi to him.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey, how's it going, Michael?
Don't want him to feel left out because he didn't get to come. So tell me what's going on. First off, let's step back to Friday. Were you involved in the IEEE Catastrophic Risk Conference that went on?
Didn't make it to that. Had prior plans.
All right. Well, just checking. Dvorsky gave us a good rundown on that yesterday. So what's going on with you at Convergence 08? Have you led any talks or heard any interesting ideas, anything you'd like to share with us?
I'm going to be leading a talk on behalf of the Lifeboat Foundation in half an hour in position I, which is in the ballroom right next door. So, it's going to be filmed, should be online. It'll be like a discussion about existential risks, and I hope that people will participate. There is a lot, there's too much to say about the ideas I've heard here. It's been challenging because there have been 16 individual talks being given at any given time, somewhere between like 12 to 16. So it's a little intimidating. I went to all the AI-themed ones because that's a topic I consider to be one of the most important. The first talk I went to was Stephen Almohandro, and he has somewhat of a unique perspective on the AGI challenge, the challenge of superintelligence. He emphasizes that AIs, even if they're pursuing some goal, for instance, like, say, a chess-playing AI or a checkers-playing AI, as they gain power, they have the incentive to preserve themselves. That would derive from merely the fact that if they were eliminated, then they could not carry on their goal of playing chess or their goal of playing checkers. So it wouldn't be like the same type of self-preservation that evolution has instilled in human beings and the rest of animals, but it would be in the service of a higher goal. And they'd also have an incentive to expand their resources and control in order to increase the probability they'd be able to keep doing that thing they love doing so much, whether it be predicting stocks or playing chess or playing checkers. So he goes that far, which I agree with completely. But then he says that it seems likely to him that superintelligences would emerge and begin cooperating, and that he wasn't really too excessively clear on it, but he basically said that as superintelligences began to compete with each other, what begins as like physical conflict would turn into informational conflict, where a superintelligence might desire to make itself as complex as possible, like as broadly structure or spread out itself over like a variety of agents so that it would be difficult for its adversary to predict its actions. So you can consider like a chess playing AGI and a checkers playing AGI competing with each other for resources and engaging like in complex subterfuge or whatever. And what Stephen was arguing is that some equilibrium would emerge based on stalemates of what he called mutually assured distraction, where both sides are so busy trying to predict each other's moves that they're in balance and no monolith emerges, which I disagree with, because if a first mover had a strong enough of a start, then I don't see why some equilibrium would emerge, even if it's possible theoretically that two equal superintelligences might get into a stalemate based on this informational warfare thing.
Well, it would seem to me that the analogy there is if you play checkers to a stalemate all the time, and I mean this is like from real life, you play tic-tac-toe, finally it's always a stalemate, and you say, this is boring, let's do something else. But you have a lot of other options that you already know that you want to do something else, right? I mean, it sounds like in that example, those AIs wouldn't have, they're just coming up with this alternative on their own, or is that, you know, if you're starting out doing something cooperative, then I can see where cooperative behavior would grow more complex. But if you're starting out doing something inherently competitive, how they're making a leap from that to cooperative behavior, that doesn't sounds like something's missing there.
Well, he kind of brought up the analogy of which is oft brought up, like the evolution of altruism in nature, where it began off competitive and then eventually. He put up on his slide like this book that said that there was like seven stages of development in the history of the universe, including like atoms aggregating into molecules, molecules aggregating into life, life aggregating into unicellular life, aggregating into multicellular organisms. So he kind of was using like each one of those developmental stages as like a justification for the notion that we can accept a new developmental stage with superintelligence where some level of cooperation will emerge even based on like chaotic and competitive beginnings, but I just didn't buy it.
Well, fair enough. I think that it sounds like there's some gaps in there. Stephen, what about you? Any questions for Michael or anything from the chat room?
Nothing from the chat room again. It's a little quiet in the chat room. Michael, I see you've been writing about bioterrorism lately. Is that going to make it into any of your talks this weekend?
Yes, it will make it into my talks, but I'd like it to. Since I anticipate not that large of a group, whenever there's a group like that's 10 people or less, it's always good to have a discussion instead of just a one-to-everyone conduit. So what I'll do in my talk shortly, in my discussion, is solicit what extinction risks people care the most about, because people, even though there are probably at least 10 or 20 possible risks to humanity, people tend to focus on the two or three that they consider really plausible and completely dismiss the others as not worth thinking about. And it's understandable because lots of the, like, there haven't been risks to humanity, even theoretical, until recently. Most analysts don't even believe that a full-scale nuclear war would actually lead to the complete destruction of humanity. So I'll just prod and poke and see what people are interested in, and I like visiting the bioterror issues because there are a lot of compelling arguments that bioweapons could be more dangerous than they have been. There have been existence proofs for terrorist groups using bioweapons, thankfully very few, but it's grounded in well-known scientific knowledge as opposed to risks that some might consider more speculative based on like self-replicating nanomachines or AGI.
Wow. So I remember you did that similar session last year, and it seemed like we had this brainstorm session on how the world could end, and it was amazing how many ways I hadn't thought about that the world might end. So once you get this group throwing ideas out there, you get some pretty off the wall stuff. Yeah. Well, zombies, for example, would be one. Anyway, we look forward to hearing what you've got going on at the conference, and of course, best of success to you and all that you do. Thanks for being with us once again on Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we're going to switch over to our next guest, and Brad, do you have one of these? Bringing up our next guest here, he's getting situated.
I've got his mic muted. Let me know when he's ready to go.
Okay. That looks like he's just about ready there. We're bringing up Brad Templeton. Brad is the chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he's director at the Foresight Institute. Brad, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Good afternoon.
Now, I want to jump right to it because you got a really provocative session that you led yesterday, and I didn't get to go to it, so I want to hear how robot cars are going to save the world.
Well, actually, they saved the world in a bunch of interesting ways. Most people thought robot cars were something from science fiction for a long time. Of course, they still show up in science fiction. But recently, the military, through its Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the same agency that funded early internet research, has been holding contests for building robot cars. They want these cars so that they can send things around places like Baghdad without having a soldier die when they're blown up by the enemy. So they've got a very strong reason to pay good money for that, and they've been holding these contests, and the results have been absolutely amazing. People have built working prototype robot cars that can first drove around rural desert roads, but going along ravines and a whole bunch of things, and then in the later stage contests, drove urban streets with other cars on the road, driven by humans, obeying signs, obeying lines on the road. So this is no longer science fiction. This is something that's going to happen really within about 1 to 2 decades. So what does that mean? Well, it's a whole bunch of really interesting consequences. First of all, many people don't know that human beings driving cars kill 45,000 people every year in the United States and 1 million people worldwide. That's the biggest cause of death for people from about 5 to 50. Among the major causes. So this is like curing a major disease. It's like, and it is about the same way people die from Alzheimer's or stomach cancer or a lot of other major diseases.
Well, you know, in his talk yesterday, Paul Sappho's keynote, one of his driving points, I wrote it down in the notes. I love the statement, people shouldn't drive. This is a thought I've had so many times when getting to and from work every day that it would be so much better if we didn't have to deal with this. Clearly,
you know, most diseases. I'm sorry, Phil.
Go ahead, Stephen.
I was just saying, you know, most diseases will kill us when we get old. Driving will kill us in the prime of our life.
But now, I'm going to skip away from that, actually, because even though that's the most compelling reason, and Paul Sappho brought it up, and in fact, it's been the big reason that most people have cited when they've talked about this, because it is an amazing death toll, and we also let cars create about 25% of our greenhouse gases. We also let cars take up anywhere from 40 to 60% of our real estate for driving, parking them, and so on. So a tremendous number of things that cars have taken over in our lives that we've become blind to. But I want to talk about energy because, as I said, transportation takes about 35% of the United States energy budget and about 25% of the greenhouse gases come from burning gasoline. And as many people have pointed out, the fact that the United States imports some large, about $200 to $300 billion worth of oil from countries that are not entirely friendly to the United States, some people believe is responsible for the oil wars that we've seen and may see in the future. Remarkably, robot cars solve a lot of the problems in building an energy-efficient car. We already know how to build an energy-efficient car, a lightweight electric vehicle that doesn't go very far. The problem is nobody will buy it. Nobody will use it. They want a car that does everything for them. They go skiing 3 times a year, so they have to buy a Ford Expedition. They, you know, go to the store to pick up something heavy once a month, so they feel they need a pickup truck or an SUV. So that's the way people buy cars today, and you can't get them to buy an electric car because the range is limited, the batteries are very expensive, and when it's finished its range, it has to sit for 4 hours getting charged again. And that just can't compete with the convenience of gasoline in people's minds. But imagine a world where there are robot taxis, and the robot taxis zoom around and can be summoned by a cell phone and come to you within 30 seconds, a minute, some very short amount of time, better actually than hailing a taxi in Times Square in New York. And these vehicles, however, are tailored to the trip you want to take right then. So if you're going downtown, and the vast majority of trips in cars are short urban trips that tend to run, 5 to 20 miles. They don't go very fast. They don't go on the highway. Commutes go on the highway a bit more. But anyway, imagine that you can have a vehicle summoned which is the right vehicle for that trip. So when you need to go skiing, you do get an SUV. When you need to go to or have something moved from the hardware store, there is a truck or delivery robot that moves it for you. But for one person going across town, it's just a lightweight electric vehicle. And we don't care about the range of that vehicle because how many of you have ever asked getting into a taxi, what's the range of this taxi cab?
Hmm.
Well, maybe in the movie Cab to Canada or something, someone did that. But nobody cares about the range of a taxi. No one cares about how it's fueled, when it's refueled, and so on. That's the taxi driver's problem. All you care about is, can this cab get me from here to where I want to go? And can it carry the people who are with me? So if we change transportation so that we take the right vehicle for the trip, we can suddenly use vastly more efficient, and I mean 10 times more efficient vehicles than we use today, which could really change the energy situation. Right now in the United States, there are really only two things that we can address to deal with our energy problems. The first is cars, and the second is electrical generation. Well, this is the thing that can do the most for cars.
So it's intriguing. Why does it need to be a taxi? Can't I just own my own robot car? Does it, it has to be a public transportation that's shared?
So, of course, you can, and many people will, want to own their own vehicles. But the equation will change. You won't need to own a vehicle that does everything you want, because the fact that you can hire out for brief purposes a specialty car when you want a specialty purpose, and that specialty purpose, by the way, could be driving a sports car in the mountains. It could be hauling a big load. It could be taking a large group of people somewhere. You no longer need to have a car that does everything you want to do. You buy a car that for your primary needs, and you hire out for the rest. And that can change the economics of how people buy cars and how much energy it takes to move people around. Now, this also has a really amazing effect on trying to build new energy and fuel technologies for cars. Today, people want to make cars that run on hydrogen. They want to make them that run on ethanol. They want to make them that run on compressed natural gas, a whole bunch of experimental fuels. Problem is, nobody wants to buy such vehicles because there's nowhere to fill them up, and nobody wants to build filling stations because there's nobody buying the vehicles. How do you get around that problem? Well, if the cars can refuel themselves, then it doesn't matter to you where the gas stations are or how many there are as long as they're not too far away. They don't have to be on your route. They don't have to be fast. You take the vehicle on the trip, and when it lets you off, it goes off and worries about how it's going to refuel itself. Suddenly, we have the ability to experiment with new fuels, maybe fuels no one has yet dreamed of, become economically viable because we have the robots not moving the cars when we're in them, which is nice and saves lives and stops accidents and prevents congestion. But what they do when we're not in them becomes very interesting, which is refueling themselves, parking themselves, or hiring themselves out. So if you own a car, by the way, one thing you'd have an option to do, not everybody would do this, but you could rent it out as a taxi while you're at work. Let other people use it, you know, have a service coordinate that for you. That might let you earn some money from your car so that you can have a nicer car and for the same amount of money, or even make a profit on your car if you hire it out a lot.
Yeah, you can especially, you can imagine... or I can imagine college students sharing cars, that sort of thing, where you know they don't all have to use them at the same time. And the idea of a shared vehicle or a vehicle that can be hired out, and it's an interesting model because the it's not like letting somebody else borrow your car necessarily. It's the car's doing the work, so it becomes a very different kind of model of use. I think we'd probably with that kind of technology, we'd see a number of different things tried out before we settled on exactly what it was that we would do.
Well, we've got 200 million cars or something in the United States, most of which are sitting in parking lots and garages almost the entire day.
Yeah.
Car share companies are cool. There's a number of them in most cities, but they don't get very many members because it's just not very convenient. You have to trek out to the car share lot. You have to return the car to the same lot. If the vehicle can move itself, and by the way, this is even before you imagine the car is safe enough to drive a person around. If it's just able to crawl along itself and deliver itself to your house or to take it back to the lot or whatever it's going to do, you can get a lot of really good stuff. But let me tell you something else about it's really interesting about the idea of computers driving cars. Transportation is an industry that's seen actually remarkably little innovation in the last little while. I mean, the streetcars and subways that cities put in today, basically the same technology that was invented in the 19th century. But that's not how it is in computers. By putting computers into cars and making how well the computers work be the important thing about the car, we bring the Moore's Law concept, we bring the real Moore's Law, actually, to transportation. And one of the things that happens that drove Moore's Law is that technology like this, high technology, is bought by individuals, and it's bought by early adopters. So early adopters are people who love new technology and too much, and they have too much money, and they buy, they have to have the hottest cool thing, and they'll buy it for a lot of money, and then 6 months later, they'll want to sell it and buy the new 3G version of it, even though they paid a ridiculous sum of money for the first one. So So there's lots of these people out there, actually. And they are what drive innovation, because they allow new, young, innovative companies to spring up, try new things, get enough of a market so that they can get investment and go on and build things. So transportation has just not worked that way. This is how computers work. This is how all the revolutions in computer technology the last 20 years have happened, is these early adopters buy things and they want to be on the cutting edge. Well, now we're going to have that happening in cars, and I think the results are going to be tremendous. And all done privately. Cities just aren't innovators. Cities don't buy transit systems that are new and innovative, because that's how you get fired.
Right.
You're trying to buy a transit system. You buy the same one that everyone has bought for the last 100 years. You're planning it with a 30-year time horizon. You're going to amortize it over 50 years. You do not buy the hot new innovative thing. You are not the first person to try something if you are a city. But if you are an individual with too much money, and there's lots of those in the United States, then you buy the hot new crazy thing, even if it's stupid, and you allow a lot of competition to take place, a lot of technologies to flourish. So we can actually fund the new revolution in transportation with private money and with private innovation. And that's, again, going to work much faster than anything we've seen in the past.
So a new deployment model for transportation is going to follow a new adoption model for transportation technology. Stephen, any questions for Brad?
Yes. Brad, where are we as far as robot cars go? I mean, what's the state of the art? How far away are we from being able to adopt this sort of thing?
Well, I don't think anyone can give you a number without doing a lot of guesswork in it. There are numbers from the teams that have been building the prototype robot cars that range from 2020 to 2030. I think sometime in the early 2020s or around 2020 is a good thing if, and here's the big if we actually put the political will behind it as well as the technological will. Obviously, right now it's not legal. You have to have a licensed driver at the wheel of a car. That's the law. So the ability to change that and the liability systems that go around accidents and a whole bunch of things are necessary for progress. If, however, we as a society want to put our minds to it the way that society put its minds to going to the moon or building nuclear weapons, and remember, I've told you about saving a million lives a year worldwide. I've told you about saving $1 trillion in time from accidents. I didn't actually tell you that, but it is the numbers that you get. 230 billion in the U.S., probably $1 trillion worldwide. Another trillion in the U.S. every year from just time spent driving, the value of that time. So we're talking about multiple trillions of dollars. We're talking about multiple millions of lives. It's worthy of an Apollo or Manhattan Project level of participation, not necessarily the government funding it, but at least not getting in the way and driving people have it. Anyway, if we have that, then we can do it. So, in fact, there's already some technology on the road today. And I love how we can use all these phrases like on the road and roadmaps and everything else.
It really applies to stuff.
Apropos here. For example, you can buy a car today that parallel parks itself. You can buy a car today that will follow the car in front of you by a fixed distance. You can buy a car that will beep at you if you're trying to change lanes and there's someone in your blind spot. You can buy a car that will actually break one of the wheels to stop you from turning into the lane when there's someone in your blind spot. You can buy a car that, if it sees you're about to hit the car in front of you, hits the brakes and tensions your seatbelts and gets the airbags ready. All these technologies, there's another car you'll be able to buy next year that reads the street signs on, tells you what the most recent speed limit sign that you went by was on the dashboard of your car. So
that's handy. I really need that.
So these are already on the market, and there's more stuff coming. All of it marketed at first as accident-resistant cars, which, of course, rich parents will buy because they don't want their kids crashing their nice car. And so this will be sold in your high-end Lexuses and BMWs and other major manufacturers. And over time, Moore's Law will make it cheaper so that it's in the Volkswagens and the Corollas. But these technologies will come incrementally. Soon you'll see, I think, cars that can park themselves in parking lots, in like valet parking lots, robo-valet. You'll see all these avoidance technologies until we finally have cars that actually almost have an autopilot. They just can't legally drive the car. And then some country, maybe not the United States, will take the leap, and in some city, it doesn't have to be everywhere, just some section of some city of some country will change the law, allow the vehicles on the road, people will see the real demonstrations, more bugs will be worked out, people will be convinced it works, and then it will spread around the world.
An incremental adoption.
Yeah. Oh, it has to be. You can't like switch all in one day. I know Sweden switched from driving on the left to driving on the right in one day, but that was a bit extreme. There were proposals to do the cars one day and the trucks and buses the next day, but that didn't work out. But No, it's obviously got to be, and that's something I should have said at the beginning. This is a vision which was created by DARPA Urban Challenge, where they forced the vehicles to win the prize to drive on the road with human-driven vehicles. This is not what some people have imagined, which is, you know, specialized roads, special lanes, walled off right-of-way and so on, like monorails and things like that. This is vehicles that drive on the road with people. Eventually, a few decades down the road, probably there aren't very many people still driving their own cars, but there's got to be a period where they're both coexisting and making it work.
Wow. Well, looking forward to seeing that as it develops. Brad, we thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Right. And I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. So
same here. Always have. Yeah. The sooner the better, I say. But
all right.
Thanks for joining us on Fast Forward Radio. Okay, we've got three more guests lined up. None of them have shown, but I didn't want to keep Brad past this time. But Brad, if you see Natasha Vida Moore, Greg Benford, or Anders Sandberg, they're all supposed to be in line here, right behind. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. You could just send her back this way. That'd be great. So that gives you a good idea of the kind of diversity of ideas that get tossed around here. I love the title. Robot cars will save the world, and as you can see, Brad has a pretty good argument to back that up. Just fun stuff. Contrast that with Michael talking to us about bioterrorism and about to redraw his list of all the different ways the world can end. You kind of get a feel for just a really broad range of topics that get talked about here at Convergence 08. Which,
of course, Brian's ideas of how to fuel those robot cars.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, it all kind of, you know, it works together. It works against each other. It's great to see how these different ideas. You know, sometimes they come together and form a new idea. Sometimes they work off each other. You go, well, is the world going to end, or are we going to have robot cars? No, but it makes for a really exciting time, a really interesting time talking with all these people. Now, I got to say, if Anders Sandberg doesn't show, okay, he didn't show yesterday either. So he works with Nick Bostrom at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. So I'm going to, I don't know, we'll have to suggest something about the mastery of time that they have over there at Oxford University at the Future of Humanity Institute. Not quite living up to.
Well, I'll tell you, these folks that you've lined up for, we could get them on another Sunday night or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Of course, yeah, we definitely can. Well, we'll see if Brad doesn't send one. Maybe we'll get one more before we wrap it up today. But is there anything in particular, since I'm here, I like to feel like Fast Forward Radio gets to be some people who weren't able to attend. This is their view into the event, and this is their chance to participate in the event. Any to have me raise any you'd like me to ask, any wisdom you want to impart to who are attending the event?
Well, I wanted to ask you, have you been to any session or anything on artificial life? It seems like I keep hearing from time to time that we're getting closer and closer to being able to build our own life from the molecule up or from atoms up. Has there been any talk about that?
In fact, we had a panel discussion on that this morning, and I will be writing a blog post on that just a little bit later. So that was a well-timed question, Stephen. I'll be providing some, obviously it's a hot topic here, one of our core topics. I am now very pleased to introduce our next guest. This is Dr. Gregory Benford. He is a science fiction author, and he's the chairman of the board of Genescient Corporation, which is a longevity-related industry. So, Greg, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Now, before we go into the Genescient stuff, I want to talk a little bit about the science fiction thing. Stephen and I, we host this podcast, and we try very hard not to go all fanboy, okay? But you're a two-time Nebula Award-winning science fiction author, and you wrote one of my favorite books of all time, Timescape, and also one of my favorite recent books, Eater, which I just got the biggest kick out of. And I wanted to let you in on something. We met you Friday evening, and I was talking about the column that you used to write, and I had the magazine wrong. I said that you used to write a column for Asimov Science Fiction magazine, and you corrected me and said, no, it was actually Fantasy and Science Fiction that you wrote that column for. Well, I was looking you up on Wikipedia the other day just for other biographical stuff to put in the blog, and it turns out actually you wrote that column for Amazing Science Fiction, according to Wikipedia, so we were both wrong.
Also.
Yeah. Oh, you did do one for Amazing. I thought maybe I caught Wikipedia in an error there.
Right, for about 5 years for Amazing and then about 8 years for FNSF sometime later. Isaac Asimov asked me to take over his column at FNSF, and then I actually just got too busy.
Mm, yeah, it was a great column. The one in FNSF, that was A Scientist's Notebook, right?
Yes.
What I was told about.
And the one for Amazing was called A Science and Science Fiction.
Oh, okay. So always great that, you know, in your monthly science fiction magazine that you would get this, like, real perspective on the real stuff. I mean, in Asimov's you'd get that anyway because Dr. Asimov would include his own thoughts, too, and he obviously was a big essayist. But I always like that perspective of the real scientist talking about real science in that forum. Now you come here, you know, also kind of as an outsider to a particular group. You got people here kind of as academics and as visionaries and scholars and so forth, and you're coming here kind of as an entrepreneur with Genesians. Tell us how that came to be.
I always like to change fields every 10 to 20 years, and I had never started a company, a startup, particularly in biotechs. I'm not a biologist, but, you know, physicists are arrogant bastards, and they think they can do anything, and sometimes they're right. I mean, come on, let's solve the central problem of the early 20th century, large-scale interstate warfare. Let's do it by making a weapon that nobody could use, and therefore the major nations could never fight again. And nobody thought about that solution. Of course, physicists didn't either. It's my favorite example of nonlinear effects. The first half of the 20th century was a slaughterhouse, and the second half was a golden age case because people just stopped being able to fight huge wars. The death rate from warfare, in fact, dropped two orders of magnitude between the first and the second half of this century. Anyway, I got interested in trying to solve the problem of aging as I got older. And I noticed that Michael Rose at UC Irvine developed these extremely long-lived flies over a period of 28 years by forced selection. He simply never allowed them to reproduce until half were dead for over 300 generations. So after negotiating with the university, which didn't own the flies, Michael did, we cleared it all out, and I and a co-investor bought the flies, did the genomics in my own home, and then mapped it into the human homologs and found over 700 disease genes in humans. We captured all the known disease longevity-associated genes known to be in human beings, except the cancer gene and a few other little ones. And that's our basic approach. We have a lot of genetic information. We then devoted a lot of effort to finding out how to act on the genes to increase their resistance to these diseases by using things that are already okay with the FDA, but were in traditional medicines. And now we've tested it on control flies, and we now have a product about to appear in about 2 to 3 months, which will be a fairly cheap supplement that acts on cardiovascular problems. And so that's our approach. We want to do smart supplements. We want to produce high-quality things you can take daily that will increase your resistance to entire disease groups, like diabetes. We also found, amazingly, flies also die due to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which nobody knew, and other obscure disorders.
Who would have guessed? That is just so strange to think that flies are dying of diabetes, Parkinson's disease, or that even that they have heart attacks. I just, you know, I would never have guessed that was an issue for flies.
Fine. They have heart attacks. They have all our problems, but none of the entertainment. Look at it this way. Flies eat sugar and fly around for a living. So they die of diabetes and physical stress and heart attacks and all of the
slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that we are used to. I found this greatly illuminating. Genesian is moving forward very rapidly. We have about 15 employees in Southern California, and we intend to produce a whole line of supplements that you can take for particular disorders. If you find out your potential, you start taking this thing, and it's possible, we don't know, that you could even suppress the onset because you'll just strengthen the body's natural defenses against these diseases.
That's amazing. Now, you say supplements, so these will not be prescription drugs. These will be over-the-counter supplements. And when will we start seeing them available?
We're going to start making them available on our website as soon as we can. It's going through the final trials on it. I think within 2 to 3 to 4 months, we'll off-sale on genescient.com. That's G-E-N-E-S-C-I-E-N-T. It was a comment that the CEO thought of genes and sentience.
Ah.
It means smart genes.
Smart genes. Absolutely. You mentioned this morning during the panel that Stephen, the panel I was just talking about, actually Greg Penford was a member of that panel. You mentioned that you'll be doing human trials starting, and you'll be testing supplements according to each of the different areas that you're treating. So you do cardio, then you do Alzheimer's, then you do Parkinson's. So do you have to clear all these trials before the supplements become available, or what's that time frame look like?
You don't have to clear the trials because first we're going to do the first one in-house, but we also have a partnership with the foundation that will do it, and they've straightened all this out. But they're all the human trials, protocols, of course. But we're going to attack cardiovascular first because that's the biggest killer. And we will simply have people take the blood chemistry, stress tests, and so forth over a period of 3 to 6 months and see if this has effects. So do the doctors. That is, if it's there, we can find it.
Great. Stephen, any questions for Dr. Gregory Benford?
I guess the choice of the flies, that had already been made before you got involved. I mean, you purchased this from another lab, the choice of using flies.
A private individual, yes, because it's the only really long-lived animal model in the entire planet.
That
it took over a quarter of a century to develop, so we're not looking over our shoulder that somebody's going to do it right away.
Okay.
But it would make a great story, the guy who comes home one night and says, honey, we're going to make a fortune. I bought a bunch of flies, right?
Yeah, right. There's hot money in the fly market, yeah. Well, it's just that flies are the standard lab way, and they don't live very long. Ordinary flies live about 2 to 3 weeks. We did this in my house for 2 months, and then we moved it to the corporate laboratory, but several of the flies got out, and we couldn't kill them. They were fast. They were vigorous. That's really the good news, is that we found that longevity leads to vigor and increased sex. I mean, these flies have sex more often than ordinary flies. They also lay more eggs. All of their big measurable side effect aspects are much better than the other flies. I mean, they beat up the other flies. So these flies got out in the house. We couldn't swap them. We had to wait. It took over 10 weeks for them to die. We got really tired of these flies. It was Christmas before they died. And we didn't let them out into the environment because, of course, they would have taken over the world, killer flies. And it's the fad Stephen King novel.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you make us all live longer, we're going to forgive you for creating these super flies that we're going to have to contend with.
I didn't create them. I was just smart enough to buy them. I mean, I made a fairly large amount of money writing science fiction novels, and because I had an income as a professor, I simply took the money and put it in the stock market. And so that, over 30 years, you'd be amazed what that does. So I had the money, and I just decided to do it. I mean, that's what money's for. It's a fluid. It's supposed to flow. It's not supposed to sit around.
Absolutely.
And I wanted something new and different to do. You know, I mean, I'm still doing physics. I'm still doing published two papers last month, two papers on SETI, by the way, and and a paper on carbon sequestration in the atmosphere. So I like working in different fields because some my critics would say, well, he just has a short attention span.
Yeah, well, lest we lose sight of the fact that you are a scientist, a physicist, a professor of physics at UC Irvine, which is kind of how we started this conversation. Well, I see we've got our two additional guests that we do want to try to get to, so I want to thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you.
Hopefully we can have you back some Sunday evening, and we'll have a longer chat about Genesian.
Excellent. Glad to do so. We'll have more products by then, I think. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you very much for being with us. All right. We've got our next guest coming on. This is Natasha Vita Moore. She is a media analyst and theoretician. Oh, I'm having a little trouble with the handwriting. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't read your handwriting. I apologize. But you're the first female proponent of transhumanism. Is that what it said? Oh, philosopher. Excuse me. Natasha, I apologize for not for getting that wrong. We're very on Fast Forward Radio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for being here. I believe I'm a media artist, not
artist.
Analyst. Although as a theoretician, I do analyze information very carefully. But thank you for the introduction.
Well, had you used the actual form, I'll read what it says. Please print neatly as though a fairly old guy tried to decipher what you're writing. So, I built my excuse in from the word go. So as a media artist and as a philosopher on transhumanism, what is standing out in your mind in terms of what you've heard, what you've seen at Convergence 08? What are the major aha points for you so far?
I think the major hot points for me are really thinking about synthetic biology and what possibilities there are. I enjoyed the panel very much, but I missed out on more and deeper interrogation and investigation into synthetic biology, what is actually going on now, where it could lead, and how that relates to specifically radical life extension and human enhancement, which I find most interesting. I know in the media arts, for example, bioart is a really dynamic field of investigation and practice, not only theoretical inquiry, but actually artists and designers working in laboratories, manipulating biology, doing cloning and genetic engineering, working with the different aspects of the makeup of insects, for example, and different types of species. I find enormously fascinating from the artistic design point of view because it offers a peek or a window into how we could alter the human body aesthetically as far as design, like perhaps changing the tonality and texture and color of our skin, for example, rather than sitting out in the sun to get a sunburn. If we could have engineer our skin to become more dynamic and change colors, or maybe have a little bit of a sparkle to it, or even tattooing, have a tattoo that is not static, a tattoo that could change shape and design and maybe have a message on it. These are elements that could be engineered into the skin as, you know, transitional type of skin, for example. Other areas of the conference I found very interesting were thinking about cognitive intelligence, thinking about morphological freedom, which is a talk that's going to come up this afternoon. Anders Sandberg and I are working on today at 3:00. It's going to be very exciting. I look forward to that. I think the most important part of the conference for me is actually seeing people face to face and giving big warm hugs and just seeing how everyone is and what they're working on.
Yeah, I was saying last night that I think that the ideas that you encounter here are so exciting, and the conversations you have, but above all else, the human contact that you have with people who have these ideas is just really what makes this a unique event, particularly that you get to participate in, that you get to create the content as you go, makes it a really unique and special experience. Now, getting back to the idea of an artist working in the medium of biology, that's an interesting idea because I think of you know, design as being the aesthetic and the utilitarian working together in engineering, and then art I always think of as being just purely aesthetic, and just art is there to create that which is beautiful and to say something meaningful. But I never think of that relationship between, say, art and technology. So what is the role of the art in preparing for the singularity, or in bringing about artificial intelligence, or in nanotechnology, or any of these kind of far-reaching topics that we talk about here?
Excellent question. Thank you. Okay, first let's consider what art is. What is the definition of art, or the arts? Art is a process of taking knowledge, re-evaluating it, turning it around back on itself, and reproducing it in new ways. Basically, art presents new knowledge, and that new knowledge can be aesthetically propositioned in visual format. It can be in literature, for example, fiction or movies, science fiction. It can be in gaming, in type of immersive design like virtual reality, enhanced reality. It can also be experience design, working with simulated experiences where the viewing audience goes into, let's say, a museum, if you want to use an old structure, and actually experiences another reality. So art is not just something that is one-dimensional or two-dimensional. It's an environment we go into as we're reading a novel, a beautiful story or a frightening story or a movie. Okay, so we take that. What is the purpose of art? Art takes us, it delivers us from one psychological position to another through our senses, through our emotions, and thereby we build new experience, and through the new experience we gain new knowledge and new ways of looking at the world. Okay, now that being said, what is the purpose or what is the function of art in biology? Well, artists use the tools of our times. When we were cave people, we used our blood and different materials like berries to paint on the cave walls to tell myths and stories about what was going on in our lives. Back to the ancients, say the San Bushmen, created wall painting and rock art that depicted their rituals of the afterlife, for example. Okay, so then we go through civilization, through time. Today, artists are working with the tools of the time still. And the tools of our time are NEMBIC, nano, bio, info, cogno. And it would be quite foolish for artists not to use the tools of our time, so we do. So we are deeply integrating the tools of the NEMBIC, the convergence of these technologies that are emerging and the ones that are already here, and using them in new ways and presenting new information and new knowledge through them. So that's basically it. We're just simply using the tools of our time, and it's very, very exciting. And I think that the arts, especially the media arts, meaning all aspects of media with the arts, can actually bring some of the information, the cutting-edge information through narrative, whether it's visual or literary, into the world to help people understand what's going on. And listen, we have poetic license, which is a good thing and can be a bad thing. So we can do things that the normal scientists, like Andrew Sandberg sitting here, Dr. Sandberg, cannot do, perhaps, because of we're supposed to be experimenting and exploring and testing and pushing the limits. So that's something I think is very important to artists.
I just want to note that Anders was nodding vigorously at the notion that he doesn't get to use artistic license. So we'll make note of that. And Stephen, any questions for Natasha?
I'd just like her to describe perhaps a piece of artwork that she's been involved with or knows of that involves some of these NEMBIC technologies.
Yes, I will have to toot my own horn here. I will certainly mention other artists as well, but a design I created in 1999 is called Primo Post Human. It's the prototype future body design where it incorporates the different emerging technologies of NEMBIC, nanomedicine for taking nanorobots into the body to doing cell repair, a computerized interactive stem cell system, say neurological relationship going up the spinal column for communications grid where there'd be little computers along the spinal column to communicate information more accurately to the brain. Something I call the metabrain, which would be AGI relationship with the neural cortex and the brainstem, perhaps looking, seeking knowledge outside of the human brain to upgrade it, perhaps give it more of a cognitive ability. The skin, I just went over that a little bit earlier, where the skin has different fiber optics attached to it. It's all on a molecular scale, basically, within the body. So that is a conceptual design. But it's one that I do hope will be realized, mainly because it's a whole body prosthesis, for example. And if someone is still has a functioning brain, that brain could be put into this body. Or if someone was animated into cryonics, for example, could be reanimated into this type of body, or parts of it. You know, you could still use the old body and upgrade it. So that's one art piece. Other artists are working with biotechnology. For example, Eduardo Katz, who did the fluorescent bunny many years ago, the green bunny, if you remember that. He's working with some very interesting types of bio art. There's Stellark, of course, who's more of a performance artist, but he is working with robotics right now in his own body to extend his own sensory capability. There's Martha de Menendez, who is in South Africa, and she is working with butterflies and changing the wing design on one of the wings of a butterfly and not the other. So you're seeing just the formation of wings of butterflies changing. And Gary Gessert, who works with irises, with flowers, he's doing bioengineering on the flowers, changing the different colors and textures of the petal of the iris.
Wow. Well, it's a far cry from throwing pots or doing watercolor on canvas, I guess, but ultimately not that far, I suppose. You know, as you said, it's just using the technology that we have now. Although, as you're talking about redesigning butterfly wings, I can't help thinking, yes, cutting-edge artists doing this now. In a few years, it'll be corporations putting their trademarks on butterfly wings and elsewhere in nature, and we'll look out and we'll see logos in implanted all over the natural world. Hopefully not. That was a bad idea. Forget I said that. Hopefully that doesn't come up. Well, Natasha, we can't thank you enough for joining us on the program. We wish you the best of success as an artist, not an analyst, and I hope you enjoy the rest of Convergence 08.
I hope I do, too, and just as a sign-off here. If anyone is interested in transhumanism, please go look it up, because transhumanism is the core of these ideas, and it is the not just a philosophy or a worldview. It's kind of it's like a mitochondria. It's producing the ATP of our sensibility. It's pushing us forward. Just the sensibility about who we are, what we could become, and how we could do it carefully and sensibly. So thank you so much for having me on the program, Phil. And I'm going to pass this on to Anders Sandberg.
All right. Thank you, Natasha. Okay. Well, we are running through it. We're running a little bit late, but we've got wonderfully patient guests. And I'm going to bring out Anders Sandberg now. Now, Anders, before I say anything else, I want to say that if you listen to the MP3 later, I was just kidding, okay? So that's all I can say. But Anders is the James Martin, is it Nesseman?
James Martin Research Fellow.
Excuse me, Research Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. My eyesight has gone on me here in the final day. Sorry, it's the James Martin Research Fellow at the Oxford University Future of Humanity Institute. So you work there with Nick Bostrom, part of that program. So, Anders, welcome to Fast Forward Radio. We're delighted to have you with us. Can you tell me a little about what you've been talking about here at the... George Dvorsky was on yesterday, and he gave us a question to ask you. He had been to your session on emulating the human brain, and he said that we should ask you about that. So what can you tell us about emulating the human brain?
Well, my background is not philosophy. Despite being in the philosophy department, I'm actually a lapsed computational neuroscientist. And what we do in computational neuroscience is taking models of how nerve cells connect to each other and simulating them on computers. We simulate...
Can I interrupt you just for a moment? Stephen, are you getting audio okay from Anders?
It's just a little quiet. There's no echo, thankfully,
quiet.
But it's just a little quiet.
Microphone okay. Up just a little. There we go. Thanks.
Okay.
Sorry.
Much better.
Yeah.
Much better.
Yeah. So what we do in computational neuroscience is making models of the brain. We're taking parts of the brain, usually rather few neurons, simulating how they send signals and interact. Now, you could imagine scaling that up to encompass the whole brain. We can't do that yet. The largest simulation that has been done so far with somewhat biological realistic neurons had 22 million neurons, and we got 100 billion neurons in an ordinary human brain. But what I'm interested in is, well, how far away are we from actually making complete copies of human brains? So we did a workshop a while ago at our institute where we invited neuroscientists, microscopy experts, supercomputing experts, nanotechnologists to hash out the question, what do we need to find out and how can we put it together? So we created a roadmap that would suggest how far away we are and what the research steps need to be done to achieve it. This is useful not only to guide research, but also to figure out, well, this might actually have pretty big consequences. How far away are we? How safe are we? Should we be starting to badger the politicians that we really need to stop it or help it or do something else?
So with that in mind, how far are we in terms of actually making it happen? Can we emulate is it even fair to talk in percentages? Can we do 20% of what a brain is? Can we make that happen? What's the roadmap or what's our current level of ability to do that?
I think our current ability is that we could probably make a simulation of a small nematode worm run on an ordinary laptop today. We actually have a complete list of all the nerve cells in the worm. We just don't know exactly the strength of the connections. It's just that it's a research question nobody has really bothered to get around to. Given our modern mainframe computers, we could definitely run, for example, the brain of a snail. We just don't have information about all the nerve cells. We need a research project to actually do that.
So once you get that info, you have all the information on all the nerves. Would it be fair to describe that as an uploaded nematode at that point? Is that a virtual neurological nematode at that point?
I think that would be an accurate description. Of course, it would not just be the simulation of the nerve cells. It would need a simple simulated body so it could be moving around in an environment, because that's the only way we can actually check that the nematode worm was actually thinking like a nematode would. So the real challenge is going to be, of course, as we scale this up to test, are we actually getting the same behavior as a real brain? It's one thing to try to get a generic brain, something that behaves like any nematode worm or any mouse, but we actually want to figure out how to take a real brain, scan it, and we create a model of that particular brain. Because, of course, if this is going to be applicable to humans, we don't want a human brain in general. Humans are individuals, and human brains are clearly individual, too.
Right, and at least up to now, want to keep that distinction. We want to be individuals, and we want to keep our individual brains. Now, one of the ideas that we were talking about having coffee this morning out in the open area was this notion of where this technology leads. And I just mentioned uploading a nematode, which obviously would be step one of 10,000 steps towards eventually uploading a functioning human brain, which I guess to your point would require a functioning some kind of virtual human body in order to demonstrate that actually was a functioning person. I mean, it would be the same set of challenges, only much more complicated. But once you have that, you've got a piece of software that is essentially, to some extent, a working human being, and then all kinds of ethical and philosophical and logistical issues arise around the sudden ability to massively reproduce human beings in a new way. Can you comment on that?
I think it's very true that it raises enormous ethical and philosophical issues. Discussions, of course, about uploading humans have been going on in science fiction and indeed in philosophy for a long time, but it's mostly been kind of entertainment. The actual possibility of it happening would have a very transformative effect. I would expect long before we actually could do it in a human, we would have animal ethics groups discussing about what about subjecting software simulations of animals to pain. It's one thing to have a simulated test animal, but if a simulated test animal might actually be experiencing real pain, that's going to be problematic. And, of course, getting volunteers for the first experiment on humans, that's also going to be tricky. But the real challenge is, of course, that once we have an emulation, both, now we got a piece of software rather than a human, but probably is an individual, a thinking being, and at least if some philosophical ideas about mind are right, a conscious being that probably should be given all the rights. But also we can make copies, which is of course going to create deep philosophical issues about personal identity, which I think is going to be just a matter of personal belief. And it doesn't matter if most people think that they will never be the same thing as their computer copy. It's enough that somebody somewhere thinks it is all right and gets a copy. And if he also happens to be okay with being copied, we're going to end up with a lot of that person. The economic effects of this has been studied by an economist, Robin Hanson. I suggest that it has enormous economic effects. It's about the Industrial Revolution all over again, but probably much faster. And if that's not a scary thought, I think there is very little that would scare you, because getting an Industrial Revolution suddenly can be a pretty dangerous thing. The real Industrial Revolution led to wars and changes in how we run our nation states and how we live our lives that is we are still feeling repercussions about. This one could do exactly the same, but also surprise people. So one reason we did this here in the entire roadmap was actually to have a way of checking how far away are we from this. And also, of course, to get a new an excuse for having a new workshop later on about the ethics and social impact. How do we figure out how to actually do this in the proper manner?
It's a huge area. I envision being uploaded, and then I'm still here, and then my copy is in the some kind of virtual Second Life kind of environment similar to my own home, and I just let him do my job. And then I can do whatever I want, right? Of course, he wouldn't see it that way. That's the problem. He's in Second Life, and he thinks he's me, or he thinks he's an individual person, which, of course, he would be, and he wants to fly around Second Life and do what he wants to do. So the ability to copy and reproduce, like, our own productive power, our own computing power, becomes this tremendous leverage for economic ability, for moving humanity along. But it's like we've already answered the question about whether we're going to allow slavery. We don't. We think that's a bad idea. And so there's this unanswered question of what our relationship will be to these entities when they come up, and more importantly, what they're going to think of us and what back to us would be.
One of the interesting things is, of course, that these entities are going to be us, just like us,
right.
And at least if it's working, because if they're not like us, in that case, we're not having a correct emulation, and most likely the brain wouldn't work at all. So at first, we would all have roughly the same values, which doesn't mean that necessarily that's the values we think we have. If there is one thing I learned by looking at philosophy and psychology, is that quite often we actually behave very differently from what we think. So we're going to be a lot of interesting adjustments, and you're going to get interesting social challenges. If there are 10,000 copies of somebody, who gets the wife? Or for that matter, during Christmas with the family, the computer is crowded. And some people are, of course, going to be happy to say, no, I don't just want to have one instance of me. The only reason to have a copy is to make a backup in the case I'm run over by a truck. Which I think is a pretty good approach. It's just that the people who like making copies of themselves and can afford doing that, or can get somebody to sponsor them because we're so great people, they're going to be more and more common. So in the long run, this scenario suggests that we're going to get a tremendous amount of human capital, but we're going to have a society that needs to adapt to a very weird changes in the idea of individuality and how one organizes one's life.
Absolutely. Okay, Stephen, any questions for Anders?
I sure do. Do you see whole brain emulation as a path to AI, or is this a way to join AI after the singularity, both or neither, or just how do you see this thing going?
I think whole brain emulation is kind of the tortoise in the story about the tortoise and the hare. AI is the hare. We don't know really how quickly AI is going to be developed. It could be that tomorrow somebody has a great idea and we're getting off very quickly towards artificial intelligence. But it could also be that we're going to get the same kind of level of progress as we've been in the past and nothing's happened. Meanwhile, brain emulation, it's a very hard problem, technically speaking. But it's also relatively well-defined. It's going to be trundling along, slowly getting better, eventually getting to making emulated mouse brains and so on. And if AI doesn't get there first, we're going to get uploads. I think if we get super intelligent AI, and becoming a digital organism might actually be a good way of getting along with AI. It might be that the future is a solid state civilization. But I think we're also going to learn a lot from this this experimentation in about how the brain works. The cerebral cortex is, after all, a marvelous thing. It seems that basic circuit, repeated again and again, can learn to be handling both vision or auditory input and doing creative thinking, etc. If we could just figure out how that works, and we could probably use that as a component in artificial intelligence and other things, which would be pretty useful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I know we've gone a little bit past our time, Anderson. I want to thank you very much for joining us and for your patience in letting a couple people go in ahead of you since you were on time and they were actually running a little bit late. But I just want to say I hope you enjoy the rest of Convergence 08 and best of success to you. We'd like to have you back on the podcast again sometime, maybe when we can talk about some other issues, maybe at a little bit greater length.
I would be delighted. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Anderson.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that does it, Stephen. We actually managed to use the full 90 minutes for once just about here. I think if we jump to the music now, we actually will.
That's right. The song we got for today is That 70s Song by Odd Austin. And it's a song about the 70s show. So, anyway, I hope you enjoy it.
Okay. One of our favorite shows. All right, well, we'll enjoy listening to that. I've got actually running very late now. I've got to get over to PJ's session. So thanks, Stephen, for keeping us going here. Thanks to our friends in the chat room and to everyone listening. We will be back at our regular time on Sunday evening next week, and we look forward to being with you all once again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, goodbye.
Hanging out down the street, same thing we did last week. Not a thing to do, but sit and talk to you. Eric, Donna, and Fez, Bob, Kitty, Hyde, and Red. There's Telso and Jackie, live in the 70s. Hang out in Foreman's basement, go to the hub at night. And Red will kick your butt, won't be too out of sight. I watch it every day, adventures from Point Blank. Look at their crazy lives, and nothing has been alright then. Eric left Donna while Fez was in the closet. There was Delto and Jackie and Eric's sister Lori. Just 6 kids in high school, man, that show was so cool. Jackie broke up with Delto. I watch That 70s Show. That 70s Show. Seen every episode, I know every line. That 70s pilot, even the Dash and Dine. And Hyde was the man, a big Village People fan. Thought he'd get a hand on the fashion candy land. Where's the bell bottom and Ted Nugent? And who's that other guy trying to replace Eric? I miss it being on television. Whatever happened to Eric Kelso on the stupid box? Was Eric left Donna for Africa in college? There was Steven and Jackie, and her job was to sell cheese to six friends in high school. And Kelso such a fool, and Casey was Eric's foe. I watch That 70s Show. Bring back Fez, and you should know that I was watching till the end. And when did Topher become a villain? Please make this stop, and bring back Eric left Donna, so he didn't really wanna. There's Telso and Jackie, and Telso had a baby. The cruiser was his car, reruns on my DVR. And I watch all day, you know, That 70s Show. Eric and Donna, Fez, Hyde, and Big Conda, there's Fez and Jackie. I own all the DVDs. Grew up here, and hey, look, it's a new year. They'll make another one, I know. I'll watch that new 80s show.